faster. People in rural Thailand in the 1970s were coming to the West for the first time. And he was in England and talking to an aristocratic English lady, Buddhist English lady. And she had many, many questions for him about Abhidhamma, which is a very complex subject of Buddhist psychology. She had lots of subtle questions about it. And he patiently answered all her questions, and then finally had one question for her. "Madam, do you practice? That is, do you have a spiritual practice? Do you do meditation practice?" She said, "No." And he said, "Madam, you're like a woman who keeps chickens and collects the shit instead of the eggs." And so I just want to say this evening, say again this evening, you're welcome to the shit in these talks, which are the concepts, the ideas, and which are, you know, this much useful. But I really hope you go for the eggs. And the eggs is the practice of freedom. You can't think your way to freedom. You can't listen your way to freedom. You can't talk your way to freedom. You can't read your way to freedom. You have to experience your way to freedom. It's the direct experience of moment by moment. And if this series has supported you to really, it has reinforced for you your intention to do the practice of freedom, then it will have been useful to do. So I've been reading the first two verses of the Dhammapada from the Buddha, this anthology of the Buddha's sayings, Gil Fronsdal's translation, about the fact that mind creates all things. Mind is the forerunner of all things. That with our minds we create our reality and create our world. And I'd like to read another passage from you, from the Dhammapada, about the mind. This is the Buddha. "The restless, agitated mind, hard to protect, hard to control, the sage makes straight as a fletcher the shaft of an arrow. Like a fish out of water, thrown on dry ground, this mind thrashes about, trying to escape Mara's command." That is, Mara being the embodiment of delusion, the mythical embodiment of delusion. "The mind, hard to control, flighty, alighting where it wishes, one does well to tame. The disciplined mind brings happiness. The mind, hard to see, subtle, alighting where it wishes, the sage protects. The watched mind brings happiness. Far-ranging, solitary, incorporeal, and hidden is the mind. Those who restrain it will be freed from Mara's bonds." And then he says something quite remarkable. "Whatever an enemy can do to an enemy, or haters one to another, far worse is the harm from one's own mind wrongly directed. Neither mother nor father nor any other relative can do one as much good as one's own well-directed mind. No one can harm you as much as your own mind. And nothing can help you as much as your own mind trained." So really the subject of this whole series has been about the fact that we actually create our reality out of our minds. Every word that's ever been spoken or written has come from the human mind. Every building, every institution, every cultural form. So the question is, what kind of reality do we want to create? And this is a more urgent question than it has ever been before. Much more urgent than in the Buddha's time, because this generation has the capacity that no other generation in the long history of humanity has had, and that is, we can destroy our world. We can destroy it suddenly through thermonuclear war, and we can destroy it gradually through climate change. We have that capacity. Thermonuclear war is a creation of the human mind, and nuclear disarmament is a creation of the human mind. Climate change has been a creation of the human mind. It has been the collection of millions and millions of human intentions converging. And the halting of climate change can also come from the human mind. That's why it's so consequential. If we go on creating the same reality that we've been creating for generations and generations, it's not a very good prospect at this point for humanity and for our planet. We have the capacity to change. This tradition and other traditions actually provide us with the tools to make those changes. We can create a beautiful reality with a lot of happiness. You know, for example, we could create an economic system that puts people over profits instead of an economic system that puts profits over people. We could do it. But we have to have the clarity and the intention to do that. Does this make sense? So this is not a little subject. And then just to bring it from the macro, the institutional, to the personal, I'd like to just give you an example of something that has happened to me just very recently. On Tuesday, I spent an hour with a friend who's quite dear to me, who is in hospice care and is well along in the process of dying. And when we got together, we knew that we were probably meeting for the last time. It was very poignant. And I was there basically to support her. I wanted to provide, she's been my student for many, many years. And I was there to provide support. And I said, how are you doing? And she said, I'm really quite happy. I'm really at peace. I'm really happy. And I could tell by the way she was telling me that it was really true. And I said, well, how did that happen? And she said, she hasn't been doing this series, right? She's been too ill to come. She lives in Santa Fe. She's been too ill to come to this series in Santa Fe, which I've also been doing this month. And she said, you know, it's been fascinating to watch this mind and to work with it. Well, what exactly has happened as you've worked with this mind? And she said, well, in October I was given the news by my doctor that I had terminal cancer and that they couldn't reverse it. And she said, I just read these statements of the Buddha about Mara. Mara is kind of the mythical embodiment of delusion and ignorance. And it's sort of like the Satan figure in the Buddhist tradition. And she said, well, right after I got the news, Mara came and said some things to me. And I really, you know, and I sort of confronted them and I worked my way through them and they fell away. And then the Mara came back and said these things. She was very detailed, and I won't share the details with you. She said, this. And she said, well, I saw that and I worked with it and it fell away. And then Mara came back and she described another whole scenario that she worked with, that she worked through, and it fell away. And she said, lately, Mara hasn't been coming. You know, she's mastered her mind in a very difficult circumstance. And at some point she said, I can't take credit for what has happened. I said, what are you talking about? How many people work with their minds in the way you've just described? You know, take credit for that. You know, I really honor what you've done. I went there to help her, and I got the teaching. She didn't need me. I mean, she was happy to see me. We had a nice time together, but she didn't need me. So we're all going to die. We're all caught inside a dying animal, every one of us. And so, are we going to work with our minds around that subject of death? Do you have any fear of dying? No. You're going to get the news. If you don't die suddenly, you're going to get that news that you have a terminal illness. And how are you going to work with it? That's really how consequential. That's just one of the things that comes up in the course of a life. So it's really important for us to, people have been challenging the idea of the word master, so you could forget that. Let's say free your mind from its reactivity, which is what causes your suffering and perpetuates it for all of us. So just to summarize where we've come in these 4 weeks is that essentially what we've been doing is mostly focusing on the way three things interact with each other and influence each other. And really we've been teasing out these three things, and it can be very liberating for us to understand this and understand it on a deeper and deeper level. And it's been really wonderful because people have shared, you know, we've done homework between our sessions, the wonderful sharing. So the first element is the physical body. And the first week's homework we had was to cultivate, really to work at cultivating awareness of the body, more and more continuous awareness of our bodies of sensations. And then to be particularly aware of the body when something challenging happens to us. And then I suggested that the homework we could do for the second week was to really pay attention to thought, to pay attention to the stories that we tell ourselves. Both these individual minds, the thought stories that we generate, but also collectively. You know, what are the cultural stories that we hear? You know, what is Glenn Beck telling us? You know? He's got a story. And to pay attention to say to really to distinguish what are those stories that are actually perpetuating our suffering, and what are those stories that we tell ourselves that actually are supporting our happiness. To really see that. And then I also suggested that we step back and actually see the process of thought. Not the contents of it, but what is a thought? Where does it come from? Where does it go? How much weight does it have? What color is it? You know, how much mass does it have? What's its shape? You know, a thought is about nothing. It is so insubstantial, and yet they run our lives. It's really helpful to see that. And to be able to step out of the story of thoughts, because when we're really engaged in thoughts, we all know this, when we're really identified with our thinking, the thinking fills the entire arena of consciousness, and it seems to be our only reality. If we just step back a little bit, it's not ending the thoughts, but just stepping back a little bit from the thoughts, we realize that thoughts are only this much reality. And that there's a vast and extraordinary reality beyond thinking, if we can step away a little bit. It's like the thoughts are this little sort of ticker tape thing that's going through a vast space. And it's so nice to inhabit the vast space instead of just having that story take up our whole reality. And then, now in this last intervening week, I suggested that we pay particular attention to our emotions. You know, what are those emotions which are afflictive, that are suffering, that actually lead to more suffering, and what emotions are actually liberating and bring happiness to ourselves and to others. And then, all the way through this process, we've been paying attention to how do these three elements work with each other. So something dramatic happens. I used the example the first week of a true story of someone recently in Española who went to her business, to her work, where she'd been working for years, very stable kind of situation, and was told, we've closed the business, get your things and leave. Was fired without any warning, the boss didn't show up to make the announcement. She was the only breadwinner in her family, her husband was out without work, and they had children. So, you know, this is just using that as a kind of dramatic example of what might happen in a situation like that? What emotions might we feel? And how are the emotions reinforced by the thoughts? And how do the thoughts reinforce the emotions? And the emotions, the thoughts? And we all know that cycle. And what might happen if we're willing to let the story go, the thoughts go, because what the story does is it takes our attention outward. You know, that son of a bitch boss. You know, instead of doing that, what we're doing is you let go of the story a little bit and you say, let me be with the feeling. If there's anything you remember from these 4 weeks, you only have to remember three syllables. Just feel it. Feel it in your body. You know, every emotion registers in the body. If we can let the story go, even if the story insists on coming back, we let it go, we let it go, we let it go, like a meditation, and we're with the physical experience of anger or fear or grief, which is what might come up in a situation like that. If we are anchored and grounded in our physical body, then we can actually go through that kind of, and we're not lost in the story, we can actually go through that emotional process much more quickly. You know, essentially with afflictive emotions, there are two ways we can strengthen them. One is to try to get rid of them and to suppress them, and the other way is to be really identified with them. I am angry, instead of saying, this is anger. Do you see that distinction? Oh, this is anger. Yeah, that's anger. To be with it, to feel it, the Buddha said, to slay the dragon, you only have to name it. You're just with it, you're with it, you're with it, you feel it in your body, and it moves through. You're not strengthening it by either suppressing it or being identified with it. So that's basically the practice that we've been talking about. And so we've been focusing on emotions in this intervening week, but it's been a cumulative process. So I really encourage us, if there's something about cultivating mindfulness of the body that has been useful for you, if you have some insights about thoughts, if you have now particularly something to share about what has happened to you emotionally in the last week, please share. Anybody? Or we can sit in awkward silence. Please.
My understanding was we were supposed to be aware of emotions, bring it into the body.
Yes.
And let go of the story.
Yes, I think that's a very succinct way of describing it. Yeah.
So all week long, I went back and forth. The afflictive emotions, the negative loneliness, anxiety was the main ones I was working with. And I would go with the feeling and bring it into the body, and I would just stay with the energy there. I'm not sure if that's the same thing you wanted us to do. I just stay with the energy as pure energy without a story.
Beautiful.
And sometimes it really became wonderful. And most of the time, it just sort of dissolved. And sometimes I was distracted by something else.
Yeah. So if I'm hearing you, I'd be really curious to know how an afflictive emotion like loneliness can turn into something wonderful. You know, if you could share, just, you said it, sometimes it became wonderful.
As I had it come in, my loneliness usually goes into anxiety. It becomes an anxious loneliness.
Yes.
And I would feel that in my body, which was difficult to stay with it physically. And the more I just felt the energy, the story would begin to disappear. And I was just feeling energy without any identification. And that's when it got to be nice.
Wonderful, wonderful. So it either got nice or it dissolved. Thank you for sharing that. That's precisely what we've been trying to do. And can you feel how liberating that is? And how, if you had stayed with the story, I'm so alone, I will always be alone. You know, whatever the story is that we tell ourselves, the way in which the story can reinforce the feeling, and then the feeling will, actually the feeling of loneliness will reinforce the anxiety, you know. And you can see how we can be caught in that loop for a very long time. You broke the loop. It's great. Every now and then. I mean, this is the most difficult work a human being can do. So, you know, the fact that it happens even once is miraculous. Thank you. Thanks very much. Beautiful example. Please.
Well, I've found this a very interesting 4 weeks. And let me say, I came to this practice via Krishnamurti, 30 years of studying him. And prior to that, my my own psychoanalysis and my interest in psychoanalysis and in the humanistic psychoanalyst Eric Fromm. And so I collate those teachings, and certainly done that over the last 4 weeks. Psychoanalysis was very good for dispelling neurotic preoccupations, neurotic tendencies, obsessive compulsive traits and traits. But it didn't culminate in any kind of freedom of this individual. And so I have walked this path for many, many years, and I don't come to these lectures or presentations, whatever, teachings, lightheartedly. I'm not here for some kind of entertainment. I take it very seriously. So I have purposefully put your suggestions into my everyday life. And so I've spent most of every day for the last month in practice. And I'm a very cerebral person, and so I focus very much on my thoughts, which I always do. But this time, several weeks ago, I began to label my thoughts. And like I say, you are, what you're thinking is selfish. What you're thinking reflects your fear. What you're thinking is reflecting your loneliness, your isolation, your control, your planning, nostalgia, the future. I purposely categorized my train of thought, and I condensed it down to an experience of I condensed it to the point that I realized that my thoughts were really based in fear and narcissism. And when I say narcissism, I'm not talking about looking at the mirror.
Right.
And then, you know, I really focused on that, and then on the feeling that it generated inside of me.
And when you say inside of you, you mean in your body?
In my body.
Uh-huh.
Or on the surface of my body.
So the experience of loneliness, for example. You know, you were mentioning that,
right? And where do I feel loneliness? And what is the feeling of loneliness? So the feeling of loneliness is fear of isolation from people around me, isolation from myself, isolation from my feelings, isolation from humanity. And I mean, becomes a train of thought that is an analysis, a surface analysis of what is going on in my own personal mind. And these thoughts control my life and my response to everything. And finding the seat of feeling was really not much of a stretch for me, because I have always, for many years, been aware of when the poison starts seething through my body, regardless of thought. And it is a seething feeling. It's very visceral. And a couple of weeks ago, I think I said, I glow with feeling. And it's negative. My glows are not glow. And then, the week, last Friday, I was delivered from a year-long curse that I thought that I was under. I thought I had cancer. Because a couple of doctors told me that I might, and I went to specialists, and the specialists I went to said, no, that's absolutely incorrect, and the proof was considered acceptable. And I thought, well, that's good. And I thought, well, I would like to go buy a bottle of champagne, but I really don't do that. But I wanted to celebrate. But I'm not very celebratory person. And I found the thing that I found most interesting about it, because the assignment was to focus on the emotion. And in my family, you're not supposed to be emotional, so that's one thing. And in my culture, my subculture, you're not supposed to be emotional. And I found myself happy by this report, but totally out of touch. Any kind of feeling of happiness, of joy, of great relief. And I thought that was very interesting and revealing. And there was really an element of sadness in that, because there was a limit, a very impositional limit in this personality.
I actually caught that actually when you were describing watching your thoughts and being able to label them. I think it's really useful for us to see the afflictive emotions, to see the negativity that we can generate. But I think if we're only with that, we can be really dragged down by it. And so I think that if you see that in your personality, if you see that there's a tendency to see what is afflictive and difficult and challenging, it's not about being in denial about that, but it's about finding balance. So when there is happiness, you know, actually to see if it's possible to cultivate happiness and to start actually to feel what it feels like in your body, to find that visceral experience of happiness, or the visceral experience of loving kindness, or the visceral experience of compassion, or the visceral experience of rapture or joy. And I think that actually cultivating those qualities, because the Buddha says, abandon what is unwholesome. You know, and we abandon it by being with it, not by pushing it away. And he said, cultivate what is wholesome. And from what you've described, it may be actually really very fruitful to spend more time cultivating the wholesome states of consciousness. You know, you see someone suffering, you're really there with the compassion. If you're feeling that quivering of the heart in response to suffering, be there with that quivering. You know, so just an encouragement about cultivating the positive or liberating states of consciousness, as well as paying attention to all of Mara's stuff too. Thank you. Thanks so much. Please.
I wasn't here for the assignment, but to be brief, I've been dealing with a lot of depression. Everybody's got a note. what I was saying was that I've been dealing with a lot of depression lately, and I have to be perfectly honest and say that when I get down there, about the only thing that helps is pharmaceuticals, and I feel guilty about that.
Really, I think if I may say, if we can see that depression, we tend to think of depression as a mental event, and it is, but it has a physiological base. It's a physical disease. And if we can see that, often the medication is exactly the right thing. I've had a lot of depression in my life. I've done a lot of antidepressant drugs. I try to have medications that don't interfere with the meditative process, but just a real support. I think that's skillful.
Because I didn't notice it. I had gone about two or three days where I was crawling along the ground, and I hadn't really noticed it. And I wound up doing something fairly destructive. When I was at the museum, this kid was acting up, and I wasn't totally understanding. I actually got called on the carpet for it. And when at that moment, when that happened, I realized what had been going on. And I went home, and it helped.
Thank you. Please, Kathy.
When I went to work today, you know, keeping in mind what your assignment was, after 3 days off, went back to work, and I worked, like, I call it a snake pit. You know how people are. And anyway, two people came at me, the supervisor and the boss, and they were yelling, and they were really excited, but mad, upset about a tea bag that I can't take up to a patient because I work in the cardiac ward, and their medications interfere with a lot of the food. And the woman wanted green tea, so I wanted to fulfill her wish and take her the green tea. But they were really excited and really mad and everything, and I stood there and I just, you know, opened my heart, gave them lots of love, and watched them. And the boss, he reworded what he had said. He backed up and reworded what he said. And they both looked at each other, and then they stopped yelling, and they both reworded it in a nice way, in a nice manner, and addressed that, I can take the tea bag and just go check with the doctor if she can have it.
Wow.
And then there was this huge rapture, all the other employees, dishwashers, cooks, it was this joy. They were all yapping away like if they'd won the lottery. And I just listened to it. It was really neat.
Were they happy because they had seen this?
I don't know what happened. I have no clue. I just don't know. And then I got a little resentful because how dare they attack me? And the story, Mara started picking in. Yeah. So I had to do the metta, wishing them all this love and praying really hard for them.
That's a very beautiful example. Thank you for sharing that, because they were reactive. If you had been reactive in response to their reactivity, which is the way we usually do it, it would have intensified. But the fact that you were not reactive, you were just there receiving them and observing them, and as you described yourself, you were open. You know, eventually, your energy affected theirs, and they stepped down what they were doing. You know, they reworded it. They were more respectful. So it's a very beautiful, what you're describing is a nonviolent response to violence. You know, it was verbal violence in this case, but you were nonviolent in response to violence, and your nonviolence influenced them. It's very beautiful. Thank you. That's liberating. Thanks. Yeah. Please.
Yeah. My most profound emotional moment this week was yesterday, and I wasn't going to mention it, but it's really a profound moment. I went to a ceremony last night for Archbishop Romero, who was assassinated over 30 years ago, the ceremony for that, and it was just kind of by accident that I fell into it, and beautiful ceremony. Anyway, they played his tape of the last words just the night before he was assassinated, and basically it was to call off the army, call off the Civil Guard, and, you know, do something for the people. The next day, when he was saying Mass, a marksman who was trained at the School of the Americas in Fort Jenning, Georgia, got him through the heart. And at that moment, I just felt this incredible, profound silence. just really signs and really clarity. Just my mind was just like kind of buzzing with clarity. A sacred place, real sacred, coupled with the sorrow. And also a knowledge that this can happen so readily, just like a bolt of lightning, just wow, out of the blue. And all of that just at once. And I really felt totally in the moment, and I think everyone else there did also. And I don't know, it was just really a profound thing. Didn't like it particularly, but at the same time, the knowledge that was contained in that, I liked that part of it. I didn't want to be an instrument of that, and just brings up a whole lot of feelings, but at the same time, there's this clarity and sorrow, which is really profound thing. So,
what you're describing, I think, is so very interesting, because mostly what we've been talking about in the course of these weeks is the reality that we as individuals are creating. And what you're describing in that ceremony last night is actually a reality that was created out of the collective mind. You know, as you were saying, we were all feeling the same thing. You know, so there's a way in which we collectively, you know, in just very recently, as you know, at the Capitol, one member of the House of Representatives was spat upon, two were called niggers, and another was called a queer. You know, and we have reached an absolutely new low in terms of our public discourse. You know, this is lower than I know, than I have remembered in my own lifetime. This kind of action toward our elected members of Congress. So there was a collective expression. The minds collectively created deep anger and deep hatred. And the expression of deep anger and hatred at the House of Representatives last Sunday. What you're describing is what can also happen, is that people coming together for what you call the sacred space and the sacred purpose can create also a very wholesome state of consciousness. So I appreciate very much that example. Thank you. So, yes, please.
I'll try and do this really quickly because of time, but my story was sort of interesting in that I work in the trauma surgery department at UNM, so it's an incredibly toxic and stressful environment. And I got called one day right when I was getting ready to leave by the ER to come see a patient by a physician who I have a long history with, who I don't get along with at all. So I was walking down to the ER knowing that it was going to set me back an hour, you know, for leaving, and I was really upset, and I'm generally kind of annoyed. And I walked down there, and I was like, okay, feel it in your body, feel it in your body. I'm going to choke him. I'm like, all right, what part of my body is not involved? And I was like, my big toe. And I was like, all right. It made me laugh. And so as I was walking out of the ER, I took 2 seconds. I thought about kicking this doctor in the butt and how hilarious that would make me. That would make me laugh. And then I realized I just had to get the job done. So it broke it for a second, just thinking about which part of my body was not annoyed. and then I let it go after that. But I have two questions for you that have been kind of plaguing me over the past month. And one of them is, when you have that afflictive emotion that you can't let go of,
right,
like the depression,
yes,
like the anxiety, like the loneliness,
yes,
or like grief when you're dealing with something,
right,
how do you break it when it's,
yes,
your, what Laura Wright said with another Dharma teacher,
yes,
that it was her comfortable sweater. It's what she turned to. How did you get that? I mean, what did,
yeah,
a cancer patient do to fight Mara?
Yes. Okay. So,
how do you break,
yes,
that?
Actually, I spoke. I think I may have spoken a little bit about this last Thursday. But let's suppose that you have a really powerful experience happening. You mentioned grief, for example. Let's say that you've had a sudden and really catastrophic loss in your life, and you're feeling horrific grief. So there's, you know, there's the grief and there's the story, and the story reinforces the grief, and the grief reinforces the story. You try to do what we've been talking about. Let the story go for just a moment and experience the grief in your body, but it's overwhelming. So there are really, my suggestion is two things, and this is the distillation of 40 years of working on this. is that the first thing is that the experience has to be contained. You know, very powerful emotional experiences can overwhelm us. We can go psychotic. You know, our minds can break. Every one of us has a mind that, if it's put under enough stress, will break. People who torture know that. So the most important thing is to find a way to contain the experience. And so if you're experiencing overwhelming grief and it's really too much for you, you ask for help. You ask for help. Please help me to hold this. You know, and you go to a grief group or grief counseling, or you call your friends, or you find whatever help you can get spiritual counseling, get whatever. Because sometimes it's too much for us to hold ourselves, and we are such crazy individualists in this culture, we think, I have to do it myself. That is delusive at times. We really need each other. And so the most important thing is containment. And your spiritual practice is a container. You know, the lineage of the Buddha is a container. There are all kinds of ways in which we contain it. And to be conscious of that, to use all of those things, including the practice of, you know, working with these three elements that we've been talking about. And then for something really powerful, we ride it out. You don't try to get rid of it. You don't try to make it go away. You do not in any way try to make it end. You simply ride it. And there's a way, and I was talking about this middle ground, if you're not trying to suppress it or get rid of it, and if you're trying not to be really identified with it, you know, and I know this is difficult, but we can have these little moments of not being identified. If you're doing those two skillful things, not suppressing and not being identified, if you found that middle ground of just being with and experiencing directly and immediately, you're no longer feeding the grief. You're not strengthening it. And in a sense, you step out of the way, as it were, and you let the grief go. And sooner or later, it will work its way out. Because what Buddhists have known for over 2,500 years, and that modern medicine is finally learning, is that both the mind and the body want to come back into balance and health. So the mind gets thrown way off balance with something very powerful, like a terrible loss and grief. If we don't interfere with it, eventually the mind will find its own balance and health, and the grief will move through. You know, and that's true of the body as well. If we can continue to keep grounding the experience in our physical bodies, you know, and not just being lost in the story, that also helps it to move through. So contain it and ride it out. Does that make sense?
And it's just
yes, it's just a practice. And there can be this impatience. Either your friends are telling you, you know, it's time for you to get over your grief now.
Yeah.
Or you tell yourself, you know, I've been grieving long enough. I want this to end. That is not helpful. It's not helpful for your friends. It's not a helpful thought for yourself. If the grief is there, the grief is there. And our task, if we want to be free, is to be with reality without resisting it. So you say to grief, you're welcome here as long as you want to be here. I will be here for you. You know, and you let it work its way through. Does that make sense? Great. It's a wonderful question. Thank you.
The second one is harder.
Okay. Okay.
But I recently had a friend who just admitted to me that she's suffering with anorexia, and I was thinking about, you know, grounding yourself in your physical body. My mother has rheumatoid arthritis, and she lives in a state of chronic pain with fibromyalgia, and my friend has this incredibly complicated and needs a lot of health between her mind-body connection. And I thought, how would you address that? Because you've been telling us for a month to ground yourself in your physical body. And what do you do if your physical body is a place of pain and suffering?
Right. I was just with this friend who's dying. She said, you wouldn't want to see my body. It looks like something that came out of Auschwitz. So here's someone who's dying with cancer, who's in kind of the later stages of dying of cancer. And I think one thing that we've been emphasizing all through this month, and I think it's especially helpful for someone who has rheumatoid arthritis is that there is always some part of your body which is not involved in the pain. You know, so you found your big toe that wasn't involved in the emotional pain, right? That was really good. And you can do the same thing with physical illness. You know, that there will be some part of the body which is either feeling neutral or strong. And so we don't spend all of our time with the painful joints if it's rheumatoid arthritis. We go there, but we keep coming back to what is neutral and strong. And we can ground ourselves in what is neutral and strong, and actually that neutrality or strength is part of the container that holds the pain. You know, so it's just as we were talking earlier about if our mind is constantly seeing the negativity in our minds, you know, we can get overwhelmed. We need to actually have the positive states to ground us and to hold us through the pain. It's the same way with us physically. Does that make sense? Great. Good. Okay. One final thing, because
How do you know the difference between being with a feeling and holding on to it and it becoming an illusion?
I think actually your mind will tell you. And, you know, your mind will tell you because watch what stories you're telling yourself. You know, so if there's grief, for example.
Yeah, exactly.
So if there's grief, yes, the mind is going to be telling a grief story.
Right.
But if we keep letting the story go and we're willing to be with the grief in our bodies, we're not holding on to it. But if we keep saying, oh, I am so alone because I have lost this so important connection in my life and it's going to be miserable for the rest of my life and I can't imagine going on without this precious being, that's the story that actually perpetuates it. It's the story that perpetuates it.
Okay.
So if you can just break the story, you know, and just be with the experience of grief in your body, you're not perpetuating it. And it might be there for a long time.
Okay.
But eventually it'll move through.
Thank you.
Okay. I'd like to, just because we're about to end, I just want to say just a few words to kind of wrap this up. And I want to be very succinct, if I can be. I said last week, you know, we've been working with a method here. You know, this method, and it's a very, very powerful method of being aware of our bodies, of being aware of thoughts, of being aware of emotions and seeing how they're working together. And we can free our minds by doing that method. But I just want to emphasize again what I said last week, is that there's a deeper way that we can free our minds. And that is by doing this practice, by doing the entire Eightfold Noble Path, by cultivating generosity and cultivating ethical conduct, really in our speech and our action, really making an effort to be helpful and not harmful. If we do a meditation practice that develops deep concentration, so there's the purification of our actions and our speech, the purification of our minds through meditation, and eventually the purification through deeper and deeper wisdom. As we do that, as that purity deepens, you know, in every aspect of our lives, as the purity deepens, there is less reactivity in the mind. And automatically, we are less reactive. You see, that frees the mind. So it's not about so much an intentional thing. It's just a byproduct of the purifying that comes from doing this practice. So yes, we do the method, but actually, if you do the whole path, your reactivity more and more and more will fall away. You know, so Kathy's example of standing there and having a boss and a supervisor screaming, you know, and just being there, you know, without reaction. You know, a non-reactive mind. So it wasn't poisoning her heart, and it was affecting their hearts. So it's liberating. And I just want to say one more thing about that we haven't talked about in the course of these 4 weeks, that it seems to me extraordinarily important, And that is ultimately what frees us is wisdom or understanding. You know, love frees us of staying connected, of cultivating compassion and loving kindness, which is non-reactive. Both of them are non-reactive. And then even deeper, eventually, is understanding or wisdom. When we understand the truth, then more and more the reactivity falls away. And let me give you a very, very specific example. Is that an important aspect of wisdom is a deeper and deeper understanding of what we call the three universal characteristics of all phenomena. That everything that happens in the conditioned world is impermanent. And we have this delusion that things are permanent. So the last time you were depressed, be honest, did you think it was going to last forever? You know? Or the last time you were in love, be honest, did you think it was going to last forever? You know, we have this elusive sense that it's going to go on forever, and that is part of what keeps us caught. So when you really understand that everything passes away, everything whatsoever passes away, there is no exception in the conditioned universe, then something really painful, like this terrible grief we've just been talking about, you know, it feels like the grief is going to go on forever. Your mind tells you that, and there's this thought, no, this is impermanent. This too will pass away. Do you see? That understanding really helps us to let go of our resistance. It really helps us to be with what is, because we know it's going to go. In the same way, you're in love. You think it's going to last forever. And so you start to take that love relationship for granted because you think it's going to go on forever. And so you're telling yourself that story. But then the wisdom comes and it says, no, it's not going to last forever. This will end. You know, every relationship ends in estrangement or death, period. So you understand that this will end. And instead of it being morbid, actually, what it does, and I've been doing this for years, and I can tell you it really works, is that this is a precious thing that may not be there tomorrow, and I am going to show up for it absolutely in this moment. So there's a deeper connection in the love relationship because you're not taking anything for granted. Does that make sense? So it happens with the negative stuff, it happens with the positive stuff. And equally, you know, that our understanding, the second universal characteristic of all phenomena, everything is impermanent. Because everything is impermanent, everything is unstable. It's unreliable and ultimately unsatisfactory. We can't count on anything because it's going to go. It's going to go away. And so there's absolutely no way we can get everything in our lives perfect. We can't make it perfect. Because it all crumbles away, it all dissolves, it's all going. Everything is totally dynamic and changing all the time. If we understand that, we do our best to create good circumstances in our lives with the understanding it's all going to disappear. There's this kind of wisdom, the security of insecurity. You know, the security of knowing that everything is insecure. And there's a certain kind of way in which you then start to play with things that change, and there's less reactivity. Does that make sense? And then finally, the great, wonderful discovery that is so problematic for so many people is nothing whatsoever that ever appears in the conditioned universe is self. Nothing is self. No thought is self. Those thoughts are talking only to themselves. They're not talking to anybody. There is no one thinking. There are only thoughts. You know, those emotions are feeling only to themselves. Nobody's feeling them.
Can I ask you one question in regard to that?
Yeah, very quick.
Is that solipsism?
No, it isn't. It actually isn't. Solipsism is an over concern about self. Just the opposite of solipsism. There's no self to be solipsistic. No, truly. And so can you see the amazing, I have to say, the amazingly liberating experience of knowing that there's only one reality, and we are it. And I described, you know, experience I had last year where all identity fell away completely for a couple of days. There was no locus of identity whatsoever. And the experience was that the wind was blowing through this, and the creek was flowing through this, and the birds were singing through this. I mean, it was just an amazing experience. And when there is no one to suffer, there's no reactivity. There's less and less reactivity. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
So that just that, you know, the understanding of impermanence, the understanding of the unsatisfactoriness of things because they're impermanent, and the understanding that there is no separate self, you know, ultimately liberates us. And from that understanding of what is true, then the mind is less and less and less reactive. And then just finally, there's one other aspect of wisdom, and that is at some point in this process, we come to experience what we call nirvana, which is an unconditioned reality. It is a reality that is permanent, is entirely satisfactory, that is whole and unbroken and unharmable. It is never born and it can't die. And we experience that reality and we come to know that that is essentially what we are. And as we ground ourselves more and more in that understanding, can you see how all the vicissitudes of life can come and go with less and less impact? What we truly are can't be harmed and can't be killed and doesn't die. And so there's a deeper and deeper level of non-reactivity. And that's ultimately how we master our minds. Thank you for your patience.